to the inside, hits four lengths back to Sway Away, and after that, Animal Kingdom, the Kentucky Derby winner, second last, leading only Dialed In, past a 46.
Yesterday at the 136th running of Baltimore's Preakness Stakes, horse racing's reigning champ, Animal Kingdom, found himself on unfamiliar ground. Just like at the Kentucky Derby, the horse Shackleford led right out of the gate, and after a fast first quarter mile, his time was just a fifth of a second from the Preakness record. The quick pace didn't stop Animal Kingdom from making a race of it, though. The Maryland native made his move and was right there with Shackleford going into the final stretch.
Shackleford in front! Shackleford! Animal Kingdom! Here's the wire! Shackleford holds on to the Preakness!
The two horses are expected to meet again next month at the Belmont Stakes. You're listening to NPR News.
Take a guess at which TV network is the fastest growing in America, where at times it beats ABC, CBS, and NBC in the key 18 to 49 demo. Fox? CNN? MSNBC? Try Univision, the Spanish-language network that began as a small TV station in San Antonio, Texas in 1961. Univision is a growing powerhouse in the American media landscape, and the 2012 election season may become Univision's moment. The man who now runs it is just 37 years old. His name is Cesar Conde, and he joins me here in the studio. Cesar, welcome to Washington.
Guy, thank you so much for the invitation to be here.
For people who are not familiar with Univision, tell me about what you would find on it. I mean, you would find, of course, soap operas, telenovelas, which are extremely popular, and some of your programs are so popular they beat out the networks in that key demo. What would you see on Univision right now if you turned it on?
Sure. We have programming genres that you would see on any network in English. So, for example, the novella genre that you mentioned. You know, sometimes I'm a little careful to clarify that it's not necessarily a soap opera, because novellas for the Hispanic community, and frankly for many parts of the world, is our primetime television.
Right.
For an actor in the Spanish language or Hispanic media space, the apex of their career is being in a novella, in contrast to an English language where one would maybe think the apex would be to be in a Hollywood movie. And we have on our air in primetime every night, and this helps explain some of the power and the size of audience that we have. We have our George Clooney, our Brad Pitt, our Angelina Jolie, our Julia Roberts every single night.
Wow.
You know, we obviously, of course, have other genres, news, sports, and the like.
Yeah.
Our news, I would describe as being a little bit different than what you may see in English language media. We certainly emphasize a little bit more international news. Mm. A lot of our audience is coming to us because they want to know what's going on in their country of origin.
Yeah.
And so that gives us a little bit of a different perspective, I think.
You have a public affairs program called Al Punto.
Yes.
To the Point. By the way, the name of a public radio program. you've had some pretty big names on, Palin, Boehner, Michelle Obama, the president in a town hall meeting setting on Univision. I read that as recently as 2007, Univision had a difficult time convincing newsmakers in this country to go on, to come on.
You know what? It was difficult at the beginning to get any of the principals from either party. And I don't think it was because anyone necessarily had an issue speaking directly to the Hispanic community. It's because this program is in Spanish, and sometimes if people don't speak Spanish, they're a little bit uncomfortable at first. However, anyone that has come on has realized that, you know, this is an incredibly effective way to reach a community that before wasn't being spoken to directly. We are very proud as a company of where we've come in just the last 3 or 4 years in the political arena.
As you know, most elected officials who are Hispanic here in Washington, the majority are Democrats. Are your viewers primarily Democratic-leaning, particularly because of the immigration debate? Or do you believe that in 2012, the Univision vote, so to speak, will be up for grabs?
I am a big believer, and I think the information and the data that we have seen is that the Hispanic vote is going to be up for grabs.
Even though in places like California, the Hispanic vote is primarily Democratic.
I think we are seeing a constituency that's becoming much more engaged. They understand that they have to engage from a civic perspective to have a voice. But one thing that's important is that sometimes people have the misunderstanding that the Hispanic community only cares about one issue, for example, immigration. When one looks historically at the issues that matter most to Hispanics over the last 10, 15 years, it's been very consistent. Number one issue on Hispanics' minds, education.
Mm.
And then the other ones are very similar to the rest of the U.S. voter, jobs, economy, health care, financial empowerment, and the like. immigration has historically not been in the top five. Certainly today, it is one of those issues that is part of the mix of the conversation.
Let me ask you about plans for the future. A 24-hour, 7-day-a-week Univision news channel is in the works. Tell me about that idea.
One of the things that we have noticed is there's a tremendous amount of demand for more Spanish language and Hispanic programming here in the United States. One of the areas that's very consistent with our mission is news coverage. And we believe that there is a unique opportunity, one, because our community is becoming much more active from a civic engagement perspective, but two, coming up onto the 2012 presidential election cycle, everyone's going to be talking about the Hispanic vote and trying to understand it. We also have a presidential election in Mexico. Mm. So we think those two dynamics create a very interesting window to be able to bring a 24-hour news cycle to Hispanic America.
You're
going to
have a CNN-style channel. When do you expect to launch?
We are looking to do this in 2012.
That's Cesar Conde. He's the president of Univision. He joined me here in our studios in Washington. Cesar, thanks so much for being with us.
Kai, thank you again for the invite.
When Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, opened on Broadway in March, there were fewer musicians in the orchestra pit than union agreements normally require. The producers had won this concession over the musicians' objections. The dispute is still in arbitration, but the musicians have taken their case to the public. Jeff London has more.
Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is a fun-loving, splashy $15 million jukebox musical filled with disco hits and lip-syncing drag queens. The show wants little more than to entertain Broadway audiences for a couple of hours, and it's been packing them in on a pretty consistent basis. So why were there 8 concerned musicians standing outside the Palace Theater handing out leaflets before the show last Thursday night?
Please support the musicians on Broadway.
Bill Roden, a retired trumpet player who worked in Broadway pit orchestras for 40 years, thinks Priscilla, Queen of the Desert represents a threat to the very livelihood of his fellow musicians.
When you go into the show, you're going to hear the sound of strings coming through the sound system, but there's not a single string player in the orchestra. It's all been pre-recorded, and we are very concerned about the live tradition of Broadway and how it is being undercut here at this show.
For the first time in Broadway history, most of the songs in a musical utilize a pre-recorded soundtrack, while 9 musicians play along with the recording. Lead producer Gary McQuinn insists this is not about cost saving, but aesthetics. He says the creative team wanted to emulate the cheesy sound of drag clubs in Sydney, Australia, during the 1970s and 80s.
It's a very kind of particular sound, and it's a sound that's actually, if you like, synthetic. We never wanted the lush orchestral sound. We never did want that. We still don't want it.
But Tino Gagliardi, president of Musicians Local 802, doesn't buy the argument.
There is no artistic reason why they had to record a whole string section and have it play along the way it is. There's only one consideration, and that, in my opinion, is financial.
And Gagliardi isn't only concerned that the show employs half the musicians that normally play at the Palace. He thinks it undercuts a very basic aspect of what makes a Broadway musical, a live orchestra.
It's not even a labor management issue as much as it is an aesthetic one. People, wake up. This is what's happening to theater. Okay, before you know it, we're going to be another Branson, Missouri. And I'm sorry, this is the capital, the Great White Way, for crying out loud.
Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me? Goodbye. You got crumbled. You got crumbled. You got laid out and died. Oh, no, not I. I will survive.
Producer Gary McQuinn says if the arbitrator rules in the union's favor, he'll abide by the decision. But he's still not going to change the show.
If this dispute got to the point where we essentially were forced to employ musicians, strings or otherwise, we wouldn't put them in anyway. They'd have to sit there doing nothing because that sound is terribly important to us.
And McQuinn wonders why Local 802 has brought the dispute to the public, months after the show is opened and while both sides are engaged in arbitration.
It feels to me like the 802 is actually trying to preempt the proper processes that are actually laid down in those industry agreements. I mean, they're outside our theatres handing out leaflets and picketing. That's just not appropriate in my view.
But after the show on Thursday, as happy crowds poured out of the Palace Theatre, most seemed oblivious to the brouhaha. It was the third time New Yorker Steve Cordovis had seen Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
It's amazing.
Were you aware of the musicians outside before the show tonight?
No, I wasn't.
They were protesting the fact that several of the songs are pre-recorded and the orchestra plays along. Does that bother you at all?
No, it doesn't.
Both sides expect arbitration to be decided within the next few months. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
In high school, popularity is often more important than good grades for some students. But not everyone can be a prom queen or captain of the football team. And that may be a good thing. In her new book, Alexandra Robbins writes that today's high school losers are often tomorrow's success stories. The book is called The Geek Shall Inherit the Earth, and Alexandra Robbins is in our studio. Welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Were you a high school misfit?
I wouldn't call myself a misfit. I was what's known as a floater, which means I could sit at the edge of most cafeteria tables, but I was never a part of any one group.
You spent 10 years analyzing the behavior of high school students. What drew you to the subject?
Well, this subject in particular, I was drawn to because I lecture a lot at schools around the country, and I kept meeting students who felt hopeless or felt like something was wrong with them simply because they didn't sit at the popular table. They thought that reflected something about themselves and it was affecting their self-worth. So I wanted to write this book to get across the message that, number one, being excluded in high school or middle school doesn't mean that anything's wrong with you. And number two, popularity also doesn't make you happy.
Hmm. You present what you call the quirk theory. What is the quirk theory?
Ah, I love it. Quirk theory. So many of the differences that cause students to be excluded in school are actually the same qualities or skills that other people are going to admire, respect, or value about that person in adulthood and outside of the school setting.
There are some real-world example of dorky high school kids who are successful today. Bruce Springsteen.
Yes, Bruce Springsteen was an outsider in school, and he has said that he started a band because he was on the outside looking in.
And J.K. Rowling?
J.K. Rowling has said that she was bullied in school. She was a daydreamer and had her nose in books all the time, much like some of her characters today.
Tim Gunn.
Tim Gunn was made fun of because he liked to make things. Now he makes things for a living. He's famous because of it. He's a fashion icon, and his catchphrase is "Make it work."
You followed seven high school students through a school year. Can you give us some brief examples of who they were or what they represented?
Yeah, what I did is I followed six outsiders and one popular cheerleader throughout a school year. The outsiders included the loner, the gamer, the nerd, the new girl, the band geek, and the weird girl. I followed the popular cheerleader to get the opposite side of the story, and that turned out to be one of the most interesting stories, I think.
Tell me about it.
Well, she was in the popular crowd. She had been a queen bee, and yet she was struggling with the way her clique demanded things of its members.
So was she beginning then to know what an outsider felt like?
She didn't realize it at the time. In fact, what I ended up doing is I ended up giving each of the main characters a challenge in the middle of the year. I didn't begin the book expecting to do that, but I saw so clearly that this girl needed to get out of the popular clique in order to regain her self-esteem. And I realized she thought it was impossible. The only way I could get her to do it was to say, this is an official challenge for the book. Then she did it.
Interesting. And what kind of challenge did you give, say, the gamer?
The gamer was a classic underachiever. He was failing school, in danger of not graduating, but he longed for a connection. So I was trying to think of a challenge that would motivate him both to turn his academics around and also that would give him some sort of connection. So I challenged him to switch from the gamer group to the nerd group. Students today think that they can't switch groups, but it turns out you can. You just have to give people a chance.
And what did you give to the nerd?
The nerd, actually, he was the one person who decided he didn't want to do a challenge because he had given up on his high school social life altogether. So many students have so many wonderful things going for them, but they don't realize it. They don't see it because when you're mired in that high school group, you start to see yourself as you think other people see you. Mm-hmm. And that can be distressing.
Does the school itself contribute to these divisions between insiders and outsiders?
Absolutely. In fact, you hear so much about schools trying to change the bullying, the clique warfare, the tension in schools, and they don't realize that they are doing things that end up contributing to the hierarchy and end up telling students, essentially, who should be picked on and who shouldn't.
Really? How would they do something like that?
Well, it turns out that I did a lot of research into social science and the psychological study of popularity. And it turns out there are two kinds of popularity. There's perceived popularity, which is based on reputation, and there's sociometric popularity, which basically means the students who are liked. Until recently, psychologists hadn't made that distinction. They just assumed that they could ask students who they wanted to spend time with, tally up the votes, and the students with the most votes were considered the most popular. But that's not the way it is, as any student who knows the difference between what they call mean popular and nice popular can tell you. So what happens is there are three elements to perceived popularity. A student has to be visible, recognizable, and influential. Well, who do you think the schools are thrusting in front of the student body as people who are visible, influential, and recognizable? It's the athletes. It's the people at the pep rallies. It's the cheerleaders.
Is there anything teachers can do?
There are so many things teachers can do, from pairing unlikely students in class to making sure they don't treat students in different cliques different ways. Also, probably the biggest surprise in my research was that there are teacher cliques out there. And this is happening even in schools that are paying thousands of dollars to try and curb bullying among students. Well, the students see it's going on among the teachers, so schools have to address that as well.
Given the popularity of, like, Glee, Napoleon Dynamite, Big Bang Theory, and the fact that things that were once geeky are now cool, things like video games and science fiction, fantasy games, and the amazing success of Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook and Bill Gates with Microsoft and Steve Jobs with Apple. Have the geeks already inherited the earth?
I think in the adult world, they're getting there. I think people are much more accepting and much more embracing of differences. And that's why quirk theory ends up working.
Alexandra Robbins is the author of The Geeks Shall Inherit the Earth, Popularity, Quirk Theory, and Why Outsiders Thrive After High School. Thank you so much for coming in, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The last time the Mississippi River spilled over on the scale we're seeing today was nearly two decades ago. The Great Flood of 1993, as it came to be known, swept through the upper and middle Mississippi Valley from late June through mid-August. 52 people died, more than 1,000 levees failed, 70,000 people were displaced, and 15 million acres of farmland were inundated. Greg Gabrielson was among the many farmers who had to test his ingenuity against rising waters. He's taken a break from planting to speak with us from his home near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Welcome to the program, Mr. Gabrielson.
Good morning.
Describe what happened on your land in 1993.
Well, I've got land close to the Rock River here, and that flooded three different times. We did get some planted, and then it drowned out. But what made the 93 so bad was even where the rivers weren't, it just kept raining, so we were unable to plant.
Wow. What did you do when you realized that your land was about to be flooded? I mean, was there anything you could do to protect your home and your farm?
No.
No.
No, you're pretty much at whatever nature is going to throw at you.
And so you just evacuated.
Well, the water came up close to our, it was actually on the grain bins and right up to the hog house I have, but I'm on a little knoll here. We were a little island. I couldn't get to the highway either direction, but it didn't get to the house.
But you did lose crops and acreage. How much did you lose?
Well, I had about 240 acres here that was all underwater.
Mm-hmm. And what crops would you plant there?
It was corn and soybeans.
And you lost the whole crop?
Basically, that year, yes. That year, it kept raining and raining and raining.
Wow. How long did it take for your land to recover?
It recovered the next year.
Ah, so it took a year. Were these losses permanent?
No. We're kind of fortunate the way the river floods us. It fills up slow, and then it gradually goes over the road. And we don't have a lot of current with it, so it didn't do a lot of erosion. I would say the only long-term effect was we had to pick picnic tables up and tires and trees and pieces of plywood.
To get those fields clear of debris, not just the water.
Right, and then even the following year when I was combining in the fall, I ran a piece of plywood in the combine. How we could miss that, I don't know.
Do you have any advice for the farmers in the southern states that are facing these damaging floods?
Well, you just have to hope for a better year the next year. We're at the mercy of Mother Nature all the time. A hailstorm can come through and wipe us out in 30 seconds. You have to have a lot of faith to be a farmer. And I my sympathy goes out for these people on the Mississippi River. It's when we think we've got it bad, we have no idea how bad it is when they're losing homes and property. Between the tornadoes and the flooding, this is the worst natural disaster I think the United States has had.
Greg Gabrielson is a farmer near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Thanks so much, and good luck with your crops this year.
Thank you.